All right, so welcome to the forenc.us podcast. Forenc is a Arabic and Hebrew language learning website for intermediate to advanced learners. And this podcast focuses on language learning, raising awareness about language programs, but also other topics of interest, including Near Eastern archaeology and history. For this first podcast, I sat down with Dr. Aaron Mayer of Bar-Ilan University, who's the director of the Tel Safi, or Gath, archaeological project. He's been digging at Gath for over 20 years, supposedly home to the biblical Goliath. But in this podcast, we talk about who the Philistines were, their proposed origins, what we used to think about them, and what we know now. And we also get into how people can volunteer at Dr. Mayer's excavation. He has a great website, gath.wordpress.com, where he has a lot of information about how you can volunteer and join them for this upcoming season. And I hope you enjoy. Great. So I'm here with Dr. Aaron Mayer of Bar-Ilan University, who's been the primary excavator at a site called Tel Safi, which is biblical Gath or Gath, for almost 20 years. Is that correct?
Even more. We're going to start our third season soon.
Okay, great. So if you wouldn't mind, just give me, you know, a high level overview of yourself and your career.
Okay. I was born in the United States. I came to Israel when I was 11 years old. My family immigrated. I've lived in Jerusalem since then. After my army service, I studied at the Hebrew University through my PhD and in archaeology, what so-called biblical archaeology, Bronze and Iron Age archaeology. And since the early 90s, I've been teaching at Bar-Ilan University. And I teach in the Department of Land of Israel Studies and Archaeology. I give courses in various things related to the ancient Near East and during the Bronze and Iron Ages and all kinds of other things, but that's my main focus.
Right.
And I've been working on the project at Tel Safi since 1996. We started it at first with a survey, and then since then we've been excavating more or less every year. We're out in the field. And we've had a lot of great finds, a lot of great collaborations with all kinds of interesting people, and right. We've published a lot and have had a lot of fun.
Great. So before we dive into Tel Safi, why did you decide to make Near Eastern archaeology, Iron Age archaeology, your career? What made you study it, and what made it stick for you?
Well, I grew up in a family who, my parents were always very interested in archaeology. So I remember as a kid, they would take me along on tours and sites and things like that. So one thing, that was something that I was brought up with. Second of all, I was always an outdoors person. In fact, if I wouldn't have been an archaeologist, I think I probably would have gone into field biology, something like ornithology, birding. And so when I finished the army, I was very clear that I wanted to have some sort of a profession that entails working outside. And archaeology was something that was always interesting. So I decided, and I took it, and I liked it, and I continued, you know. And, you know, very often your career choices and your life, you know, choices are a combination of being at the right place at the right time and doing something that is fun or isn't fun, et cetera. So right. I think everything converged very well for me there.
So now time for the high level overview of Tel Safi. So I mentioned before, it's widely, the consensus now is that it probably is the site of biblical Gath.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can give me your own high level overview of the site and a very short history in terms of its discovery and where we are now.
Okay. Tel Safi is one of the largest sites, pre-classical, pre-Hellenistic sites in Israel. And it's been known to be an important site since the mid-19th century. And already in the mid-19th century, many people had suggested that that was the location of Gath. And that was the main reason that in 1899, the British-led expedition by Bliss and McAllister from the Palestinian Exploration Fund excavated at the site for a few weeks. Very fortunate for us, they only worked there for a few weeks. They were limited in where they could work because they didn't get along with the local villagers. And after a few weeks, they left. And why am I saying we're lucky? Is because the manner in which they excavated and the manner in which they published the excavation was horrendous, even on scales of, even on the standards of 1899. So the very fact that they didn't excavate a lot saved the site for later periods,
right,
or for later excavations. Now, after the 1899 excavations, the site was basically left alone for the reason that for quite a few years there was a very intensive debate whether it was or it is or is not got to the Philistines. And from the 1920s onwards, for many decades, the commonly held view was that, which had been suggested by Albright, William Foxwell Albright, who had suggested that Gat is somewhere else, and probably at a site called Tel Arani, which is near Kiryat Gat, which is about 20 kilometers to the south of Tel Asafi. And since he was a very dominant persona in archaeology, that was more or less the accepted version. And it was only in the 70s that Anson Rainey from Tel Aviv University, and actually Bar-Ilan University as well, came up with the suggestion that we should return to the identification of Gat the Philistines at Tel Asafi. In the meantime, very few people were thought of excavating it because the commonly held view was that the modern village of Tel Asafi, which was an Arab village which existed on the site till 1948, completely covered the ancient remains. So people said, you know, even though it might be an important site, and even though there might be great Bronze and Iron Age remains, who wants to excavate first a modern and medieval site and only then to get to the thing? So I know several of the, let's say, the scholars of the past generation, you know, my teachers and my teacher's teachers, who came to the site, looked at it, said, yeah, let's go on somewhere else. So it wasn't touched. The only person who actually worked there was the late Moshe Dayan, and he did illicit excavations there. And as part of his illegal collection of finds, some of which are now in the Israel Museum, a lot of them came from Tel Asafi. But that doesn't count as excavations.
Right.
So in the mid to late 90s, I was finishing my PhD at Hebrew University, and I'd spent about 10 years working in the Jordan Valley, which is extraordinarily hot, and I decided I want to work somewhere which is not as hot.
Uh-huh.
And I made a vow that I wouldn't spend two consecutive days in the Beit Shean Valley after my doctorate, and I've kept to that vow. So then I was looking for a site to work on. And along with two friends of mine, we decided we want to start a project. We went to Tel Asafi, and each one of us was interested in different periods. For various reasons, in the end, I was the one left there. Bailey was the person interested in the classical periods. There wasn't too much classical periods, and the person interested in the medieval period, the Crusader castle there, we couldn't excavate it because it was covered by a modern cemetery. So in the end, they left, went to other projects. I stayed on the project. And since 1996, we started with a survey to define the site. And that was a very important thing because in the survey, we found that the site was much larger than previously thought. In the past, it had been assumed to be about 175 dunams. It turned out to be about 500 dunams. And another thing that we found is that while there is a modern and medieval village on the site, it only covers a small portion of the site. And major parts of the site were the early remains were close to surface. And that, in fact, opened up the possibility of reaching the Bronze and Iron Age remains. And so basically from after that survey season, we've been excavating in the various areas, whether in the upper city or in the newly discovered lower city, where we have Bronze and Iron Age remains right near surface. And since then, the excavations have been extraordinarily fruitful. Mm-hmm. And we've had remains from the early Bronze Age, from the middle and late Bronze Age, and various stages of the Iron Age. The Canaanite city up until the end of the Bronze Age, the several stages of the Philistine culture, then the destruction of the Philistine city of Gat, which we attribute to Hazael, mentioned briefly in 2 Kings 12:18, with an enormous siege system that surrounds the site. And then the site is destroyed. And then there's a short Judahite phase when probably during the period of the king Hezekiah, the site is settled by the Judahite kingdom. Then again in the Persian period, and then less during the classical periods, and then again in the medieval and modern period. So we have more or less a continuous habitation at the site from the proto-historic until the modern period, until right. 1948 when the village was abandoned.
And can I ask, is it it's not a man-made tell, it's a natural hill, correct?
Well, it's a natural hill, which has in certain places meters and meters of man-made deposits.
Right. And when you just as a broader question about archaeology in general, when you're identifying these tells, like, you know, say that this place hadn't been excavated before, if you were to see this on the horizon, would it stand out to you as that's an obvious location for habitation?
Yes. And, well, first of all, it's for habitation. It is. And also, as soon as you come close to the site, you can see the actual remains, you know, the walls and archaeological finds that pop up immediately. Mm-hmm. That's very clear.
And was there a tradition amongst the local villagers that this was, because I know for other sites, other biblical sites or historical sites, the villagers do carry on sometimes the tradition that this was a location of XYZ. Did that exist at Tel Asafi?
Well, there was a tradition of, let's say, going back to the medieval period, but interestingly, the identification of the site as Gat was forgotten in the modern period. And because the site's called Tel Asafi, and it's not anything like Gat. Right. And that's one of the reasons why there was a debate among the scholars, what's the identification of Gat. Now, what they try to do is you take the mention of Gat in various ancient sources, whether it's biblical, Assyrian,
right.
And you, where does that fit in geographically? And then you add to that the finds at the site. So even though we haven't found the entrance sign to the site, you know, saying welcome to Gat, the combination of the geographical data on the one hand and the periods that we have and the periods that we don't have at the site make it very, very, I would say, you know, without reasonable doubt,
right,
that this is the son of God. And I think it's quite clear now.
Are there extra biblical references to God?
Well, there's God apparently is mentioned in an Assyrian text, which is either from the reign of Sargon II or Sennacherib.
As God, like, so the naming convention is similar.
Well, the whole, it's the royal city of something, and it's recreated as reconstructed as God. Hmm. It's mentioned also in another Assyrian text. It's mentioned as a site where there was a king from the late Bronze Age during the so-called El Amarna archive from the 14th century BCE. And it's also mentioned in later medieval and classical period texts as well.
So just to be clear, so when we're looking at the Assyrian texts, the name, they use a name similar to mm-hmm. God, or they're describing an area that you think they're referring
yes.
to? Okay.
No, they use a name, something like Ginti or Ginti or something like that, which is a similar name. Yeah.
And then, not to get too off topic, but just because it popped into my head and it interests me, do the other Philistine cities that we know of that their names remained, like Ashkelon, do those mean anything? One, what do we know about the Philistine language? And then do we know if they have a linguistic meaning to them?
Well, actually, from what we know, all the names of the Philistine cities that we know of have non-Philistine names. They actually have names that were already given to those sites before the Philistine culture appeared.
Okay.
So they're probably Canaanite names that were continued to be used. Just like, right. I mean, we live, you know, people who live in Cincinnati, Cincinnati is a Indian name or North American, you know, Native American word and not an English word.
Okay. So now I know we're covering a lot of topics that on any one of these you could spend days talking about or more. But I want to get into who the Philistines were. Mm-hmm. So if you can touch on, you know, the original theories, the original theories about their origins, mm-hmm. and then what the consensus is now.
Okay. Well, first of all, there's never a consensus. You should know that everybody always argues. But the view now, I mean, the traditional view was that around 1200 BCE, with the collapse of the Late Bronze Age culture, so we'd usually assume that the Philistines were one of the peoples who were the result of the collapse of the Bronze Age civilizations. Let's say somewhere around 1200, there was major changes in the Eastern Mediterranean. The Mycenaean culture collapsed, the Hittite Empire collapsed, the Egyptian Empire was weakened, many Canaanite cities were destroyed or abandoned, and that's the time when the more or less the Trojan War occurred. That's the time when the Israelites appeared, the Philistines appeared, the Arameans appeared, etc. So it was assumed that the Philistines are a people coming somewhere from the area of Greece, perhaps related to the Mycenaean culture, the Bronze Age culture of mainland Greece. And they arrived in Canaan with a Mycenaean-like, Aegean-like culture, settled in the southern coastal plain as part of a broader phenomena called in modern terms the Sea Peoples phenomena. And supposedly the Philistines were one of the Sea Peoples who tried to invade the area of Canaan, which was under Egyptian control. The Egyptians supposedly, beat them. And then the Philistines settled in the southern land of Israel along the southern coastal plain in the area more or less between modern-day Tel Aviv and modern-day Gaza. And there were five cities and a hinterland around, and they started forming their culture. This culture then supposedly became stronger, and it came into confrontation with the early Judite-Israelite peoples, first tribes, then the early Judite kingdoms.
So I have a couple questions into that, and sorry to interrupt you. So when they arrived, the site was probably occupied before by, it was a Canaanite city, as were most of these other cities. Mm-hmm. From the Philistine remains that we're finding, were they a more or less advanced culture than the existing one?
Well, part of the previous paradigm was that A, they arrived and destroyed the Canaanite cities, and B, they brought with them a technologically superior culture. One of the reasons that we've been in recent years saying the traditional paradigm is a bit shaky is that when you look at almost all the Canaanite cities in Philistia, they weren't destroyed in a massive destruction, but if anything, just maybe certain parts of it were destroyed. That's one thing. And the other thing is, when you do see the early Philistine culture, it's very often mixed in with local Canaanite culture, and the Philistine culture from abroad is not from one area. It's not all from Greece or all from Cyprus or all from Western Anatolia or whatever the sort, but it's a mix of it. So nowadays, a lot of people are talking about that. What we have is a very mixed culture, what we call an entangled culture, comprised of peoples of various origins, local and foreign, who, due to the period of collapse and transition between the Bronze and Iron Age, arrived in this region. And when they arrived in the region, they coalesced into a unique culture during that period, and which then became the Philistine culture. Now, for example, you had asked before, what about their language? So in the past, everybody was saying, okay, eventually we'll find the Greek-like language of the Philistines. Mm-hmm. All we have to do is find an inscription, a long enough in Philistine, early in Philistine inscription, which we'll be able to translate, and we'll know what the Philistines spoke. After many, many years of excavating Philistine sites, there are very few inscriptions, and I would bet that we're probably not going to find many more. And most probably the Philistines, if they spoke foreign languages, it wasn't a language. They may have spoken several languages because they're coming from different places. Mm-hmm. And they may not have come with a knowledge of writing, because not everybody in the ancient world had a writing system that they used. So even the limited amount of Philistine, early Philistine inscriptions leave us very much in, you know, with a big question mark of what were their languages, what did they write, if at all did they write.
Right.
Now, as far as their technological complexity, they do have, on the one hand, some aspects which indicate that they were, you know, had complex and more advanced architecture, more advanced pottery skills, etc. But the image that you have of the Philistines in the Bible, of this massively armed, well-organized, very, very martial society, is not fully supported by the archaeological remains.
Right.
I have a feeling that the biblical description of the Philistines is a combination of reality, but also a lot of hyping up your enemy or who you eventually manage to beat to show that how strong you were.
And there's also, couldn't there also be a component of when they were writing the biblical texts, they were, you know, if they're talking about an ancient military force that were their enemies back in the day, they'd really only be writing about what they see in front of them, you know, more advanced armies of the time, right?
That's true. That's true. I think it's a combination of both. You write about what you know, and you also try to exaggerate, you know, and make a great story about something that, you know, I always say, you know, if the amount of people that claim that they're descendants of the people on the Mayflower were true, then Mayflower would be the size of the Queen Mary II. You know, the amount of people that had to be on that ship. So I think you sort of like, very often in, you know, depictions of the past and of your social memory of that you create of the past is something that's exaggerated.
Right. And one thing that's always interested me too is a couple of topics. So first, there's, I don't know if this will ever go away, but this aura of mystery when it comes to the Sea Peoples, because mm-hmm. they appear on the scene, they're kind of mysterious because you don't know a lot about them. You know, I think their place in the Hebrew Bible adds to their mystery and aura, but it's not an unheard of thing of a population, you know, a people leaving one area and conquering another area or settling in another area because of whether it's general collapse or drought or mm-hmm. other factors. It's not that mysterious.
Well, I think the Sea Peoples, first of all, by the way, the Sea Peoples is a modern term. It's not an ancient term. Mm-hmm. And the Sea Peoples, were comprised of different people. Some of them, we have archaeological evidence of them, the Philistines, even if we understand the Philistines differently than we understand in the past. Nevertheless, a large and significant portion of the Philistines did come from the West. Now, for example, my colleague, Louise Hitchcock, and myself have been arguing recently that we should see some of the Philistines as pirate-like people, that during this collapse period, one of the things that happens very often is that pirate-like activities go on. So perhaps the Philistines were also pirates, or some of them are also pirates. On the other hand, some of the other groups of the Philistines, of the Sea Peoples, who supposedly should be found in the coast north of Philistia, in the coast of Lebanon and Syria, there's very little evidence of them. And if anything, more and more evidence is that in those areas, the Canaanites continued to exist and developed into what we later call the Phoenicians, and that we have very little evidence of a significant portion of people coming and settling in those regions, which in theory would be the other Sea Peoples. So the picture is very complex. Now, that said, there is no question that there was a significant component of what was going on in the late Bronze Iron Age transition of people coming from outside.
And is
that there was, you know.
This is kind of going off of just that when you mentioned the Philistines' arrival on the scene and that it coincides with the Israelite arrival on the scene and the formation of the tribes of Israel. When you're looking at the Israelite reaction to the Philistines, what does that tell us about who the Israelites were? Like, what were their origins? As in, I know there, you know, were they, does it speak of them as somebody who have been here for a while in terms of the theory of that they were Canaanites who, with the collapse of civilization, created their own culture? Or does it speak to you as another new population on the scene who's competing with the Philistines?
Well, first of all, most of what we read about the early Israelites in the biblical text is written down very later, much later. And one of the best examples of that is that there's no memory in the biblical text of the Egyptian presence in Canaan, or not directly.
Do you think that's on purpose, or do you think it was just a natural
It
omission?
could, it could, you know, it could very well be that. Because this was written years in generations afterwards, that memory was not preserved. Now, archaeologically, most scholars accept the view that a very significant portion of the early Israelites were local Canaanites that, for whatever reason, coalesced into what's later known as early Israel. Now, it could be that there were components coming from outside, but a very significant portion of the early Israelites were local Canaanites, who, whether they were a highland people who developed into this group, or were they, some people suggested that they were Canaanites from the lowlands who escaped to the highlands, whatever it is, but they were a big portion of them were local people who then became Israelites, now became defined themselves as Israelites. Now, the description of the Philistines in the biblical text is, again, on the one hand, does have hints of early Iron Age realia, things that were going on in the early Iron Age, but it's not a blow-by-blow description. Now, the biblical text goes back again and again and tells us that the Philistines came from the west, from Kaphtor, from probably Crete or from other areas. So there is a tradition that the Philistines came from outside, and the reason being is that the Philistines retained non-local aspects of their culture to the very end of the Iron Age. So it was probably an important part of their identity that they, were we put our focus on the non-local aspects of our identity. So that probably was known by the Israelites. Now, how does that reflect on whether the Israelites saw themselves as local or not? Clearly, the image that the Israelites were trying to portray was that they were here originally and that they were kicked out and they came back, et cetera, et cetera. So, and again, that's all part of competing, let's call them foundation stories. Just like today, you have the Israelis and the Palestinians competing. Who is first and who's longer and who has a more connection to the land, et cetera. I'm sure the same types of things were going on in the Iron Age Levant as well.
And this is another loaded question, and you can pass on it if you want.
Yeah.
But if history had turned out differently, and say the Israelites were the ones who faded away and the kingdom of Judah never came into being, and on and on and on, what would the Philistines had been the ones to go on? What do you think they would have said about the Israelites or the Judahites in their texts from their perspective?
Well, listen. History is always written by the people who won, and our view of the Philistines is to a large extent, before archaeological finds gave us more data, was based solely on the biblical text. And the biblical text portrays the Philistines as on the one hand, mean, strong, and technologically superior, but the horrible enemy. So it's clearly a very, very one-sided view. I mean, imagine if you wanted to study what happened in the first Gulf War, and you had the New York Times and the Baghdad Times. So reading one or the other, you'd have a very different picture of what was going on. So the same thing goes for reading the biblical text, or for reading the so-called Philistine biblical text, which we don't have. Maybe there was one, but we don't have it.
For someone like you who's so invested in the field and you have a very good understanding of the developments in the region and the history versus what's written down in the biblical text, how has that shaped or impacted or affected your personal faith as someone who's Jewish?
I don't think it's affected it very deeply because, I never looked at the biblical text as something, whether David did or did not stand on his porch and look down at Bathsheba taking a bath, that's not going to determine whether I will be, Jewishly connected, whether I will be, I will feel a connection to Jewish culture, history, tradition, et cetera, et cetera. That's not the point. And also I try as much as I can, you know, nobody is objective, but when I'm dealing with archaeology, I try to deal with it in as an objective as possible way. Trying to, and I'm sure I don't successfully do, but I'm trying to shed my baggage, put my ideology to the side, right, and say, okay, this is what I'm coming with. Let's try to look at it from a more objective point of view. And I don't think there is no such thing as objective science. Mm-hmm. Everybody carries his baggage with him, but I think it's our duty to try and do it as least as possible. Right. So I try not to come with an agenda of I'm going to prove the Bible. I'm going to, prove, the Jewish rights for the land of Israel, et cetera, et cetera.
Of course, but on a personal level.
Yeah, I'm saying no.
Right, when you're at home.
But on a personal level, some people do that. So I think I'm trying to say that, I'm a Jew. I'm a committed Jew. I'm a committed Zionist. I live in Israel. I find my connection to the land very significant. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I'm an archaeologist who's studying the past, trying to be as objective as possible in the study of the past and not bring the baggage with me to the forefront when I'm studying the past. I think that's very important for me.
Yeah. Well, that speaks to your professionalism. And also a wider thing that I noticed when I did my master's at Hebrew University in Islamic and Middle Eastern studies. And it was one of the things I was most struck by was that all the professors I had were they taught the material from an objective standpoint when they didn't necessarily have to. They approached it as academics. And I'd found from my undergrad studies in the U.S. that the situation was the opposite, that there was often an agenda.
Well, I'll tell you why, perhaps because in the past, particularly in the early Zionist, and the early state, history and archaeology was very, very much used as part of the Zionist agenda. Mm-hmm. And so I think academics and scholars are trying to very much to, not all of them, but many of them are trying to that's one thing, archaeology, another thing, ideology, let's try to keep them separate. Now, again, I don't think any of us are 100% successful. We all bring our baggage with us, but we're trying as much as possible to leave it to a carry-on case and not to a arch trunk.
Yeah. Right. So I guess as Israelis, you guys are more sensitive, I guess, to that aspect of it.
Perhaps, yeah. I think so. Because we're very often accused of not being that. So I think we're very, it's very much at our in our awareness.
So getting into the excavation seasons, opportunities for volunteer work at Tel Asafi, when does the season begin and how does somebody volunteer?
Well, the season is from June 24th to July 20th. That's 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. Excavation this season will be excavating in the lower city where we have mainly Iron Age remains. We've actually, after 20 years, we've basically shut down the upper city, and now we're concentrating on the lower city. And this is also, the finds there are very close to surface. We've had a lot of very nice finds, probably the city gate, fortifications, a temple, all kinds of other interesting finds. And the best way to sign up is to go to the website. That's gath.wordpress.com. One of the pages is for registration, online registration. If you have any questions, they can write directly to me, aaronmayer@gmail.com.
And types of volunteers.
Join the fun.
You get a wide variety of people.
We get everybody from age 16 to 80, students, volunteers, professional archaeologists, high school students, everything, any type from any place in the world, from any background. We've had thousands of people over the years. And I don't think a single person has been on the site and said, Aaron, I'm sorry I came. Everybody enjoyed it. It's a very fun and enriching experience. And that's, I think, the most important thing about it. And we work very hard at making it a both an enjoyable experience, but also a learning experience. It's a teaching excavation. And the idea being is that whether you're a first-year student, a PhD, a volunteer, a high school student, or just an interested layman, that you come there and you learn and you have an interesting time, and you know, you leave enriched.
And in terms of how potential volunteers could set expectations and have a longer term view of volunteering at the site, what can they expect to do their first year on the site compared to when, if they come back two years later?
Well, first of all, I always like to say that field archaeology is not rocket science. So if we ask that volunteers come for 2 weeks, a minimum of 2 weeks, and usually by the end of the first week, volunteers have already learned the basics, and they know what they have to do, and they know who to ask if they don't know what to do, and they learn quite quickly. So a volunteer, you know, you're not there to move dirt. You're there to excavate, to understand what you're doing, to learn from it, and to enjoy yourself and to enjoy the fun of finding things. And it's a very, very significant portion of the staff's job is to make sure that people are participants. You know, we're all a team. We're, you know, it's not, you know, archaeologists who have laborers. It's all a group of people working together. So I think from the, you know, within a few days, people already know what's going on. There's a whole variety of different types of work to do. And even people who have physical limitations, we have what to offer them to do, whether work in the field or work on analysis of finds in the field office. There's always something to do for whatever type of physical shape you're in and what you're interested in.
And how much longer do you guys think you're going to be excavating there?
Well, right now I have a feeling that we're going to be working for another 3 to 4 seasons. Mm-hmm. Because you also have to, you know, after 20, you know, 20 something years, you have to say, you know, this is what I can do in my lifetime. You could theory work at this site for 200 years nonstop. You want to make sure that everything's published, everything's, you know, and also another thing is that work at a site for 20, 25 years, stop then. And in 20 years from then, let someone else start there. And archaeology will be more advanced and, techniques will be more sophisticated. And they'll understand more about the site, you know, once they go back. And as far as I'm concerned, they can say that I didn't know anything. I was backwards. I was like Bliss and McAllister. And let them understand better, yeah.
Just in terms of your professorship at Bar-Ilan, are you looking for PhD students? If so, you know, why would you encourage people to come and study with you?
Well, we're definitely looking for PhD students. I would say, first of all, the reason to study in archaeology in Israel is because hands-on with the material that you really don't have an opportunity very often in when you're starting abroad. I mean, not to mention that if I have a question regarding to the site, I can take my students and go out for a day of excavation in the field within a week's notice. With no problem. I mean, I don't have to plan an expedition, you know, months ahead. I can, you know, if I want to check something, I go out in the field and add to that, if you're a PhD student, you get to know the sites in the country, you get to know the finds in the country, you meet other archaeologists, and you're not isolated, you know, somewhere in some, you know, some university in the wherever, you know, in the Midwest or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's another advantage. One advantage. Another advantage is if you come to, for example, Bar-Ilan University, do a PhD with me, you work on the material from the excavations and the materials are there. Very often, the materials from the excavations are left in the country where they were excavated and you go back to the United States or Britain or whatever, and you just have your notes from what went on. So it's also a very big advantage. And, you know, we have exciting programs. You know, we have, you know, good teachers, exciting programs, Things are popping, you know.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's great. And restate your website one more time for
gath.wordpress.com.
Well, I encourage everybody to visit that site. You know, your personal enthusiasm for the subject really comes through when talking to you, but also on your website. You're an active blogger, and I think you're pretty unique when it comes to working archaeologists. in terms of, you know, your passion for it and how you approach it. It seems like you're really trying to bring in as many people as you can.
Well, listen, I think if we don't, the public funds most of what we do. If we don't enable the public to at least get some of the feeling what's going on, then we're not fulfilling our aims. You know, it's not just an arcane ivory tower profession. We have to involve the crowd, the people in what's going on. I mean, they can't make the decisions on what we do and what we don't do, but we have to participate in explaining to the public what's happening.
Right. Well, once again, I really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.
I hope I can definitely talk to you again. Anytime you have a new find you come across that you want people to know about, definitely hit me up and we'll do it.
And again. If you send me a link to the podcast, I'll put it on the website.
Well, for sure. Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, great speaking to you.
And I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, great. See you around.